Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Darren Lewis of the Daily Mirror and Miguel Delaney of the Sunday Independent. Now let's be honest, Chelsea had a bit of an image problem. They won trophies rather than admiration. They were too ruthless to be loved. Enter Antonio Conte. All changed, Darren?
Absolutely, all changed. I was at the game on September the 24th when they lost to Arsenal 3-0. Arsenal were home and hosed by half-time and Chelsea looked a shambles at that point. So you talk about winning admiration. He certainly has done that for the way that he's transformed the side. He's made most good use of Victor Moses, his predecessor. Wouldn't have him anywhere near the squad and sent him out on loan. Jose Mourinho at left back. Lots of people underwhelmed when Marcos Alonso came in, having been at Bolton and Sunderland. He now slotted right into that tactical system. Costa up front, combustible, fallen out with him earlier in the season, but playing out of his skin, the most potent striker in European football at the moment. I think the job that Antonio Conte has done at Chelsea is nothing short of terrific. He's only midway through it, of course, but so far, so very good.
He's got Eden Hazard playing, and the little scamp has been saying, OK, there's a three-horse race, this title, Chelsea, City, Liverpool. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it was so conspicuous the way he left out Arsenal. Now, it's almost like we've conditioned to think that way, just because the last few years, no matter what Arsenal do, there's always a sense of, well, it's going to end up the same thing again. But so in terms of Chelsea, what was particularly interesting about this game was that this was different to basically all the other games in this run, and that finally, I mean, the way Spurs played the first half hour and then scored on the first goal against them for 60
real
minutes.
Real intensity about it.
Exactly. Well, the way Spurs went that, it reminded me of the way Liverpool beat Chelsea in a 2-1 in that game. And then obviously they got the goal, which is the first Chelsea had conceded since Arsenal. So I think that's what made it all the more impressive with Chelsea, because, I mean, when you get on one of these runs, you often sense a team like they're on this kind of, they've got this momentum, this kind of, they're all in sync. But it's when it's rumbled then, suddenly, sometimes it all falls apart. I mean, I suppose a famous example was Liverpool at the end of 2013-14. Now, obviously, it's a different situation because of the tension involved and all that. But like, once that kind of, the kind of cloud of confidence is disrupted a bit, players sometimes struggle to recover. The Chelsea did look on the ropes, but then the way they came back at Spurs, and like I think for that 20-minute spell, just either side of half-time, it was them doing to Spurs what Spurs had been doing to them for the first 20.
You know, the interesting thing, Mike, is that when Luis arrived, and all of us were deriding Luis because we all know he was a bit kamikaze in his first spell in English football and has been since. But he said to us at the time, Conte, I'm going to show you that he can be a good defender. It's my job to coach him and make him into a good defender, just like I did with the defenders at Juventus. And he has done that. He's actually shown us that he can coach and turn players that we see as average or maybe not quite at it into quality players.
We've had Max Bentley on, Miguel. He's asking, are we wrong to dismiss the two North London sides? Out of those two, Arsenal unbeaten in 19, that's got to count for something, isn't it?
Yeah, the one slight worry with Arsenal thing, I know they won again yesterday, but performances have dipped a bit in the last few months. I mean, because about a month ago, leading up to that kind of the Basel-Ludogorets game in the Champions League, they were absolutely brilliant and they were flying. It was some of Wenger's best football. I think they've lacked Cazorla, though. When they don't have Cazorla in the team, I mean, for all these fast players they've got, it's almost like they've got no one feeding the ball. They're a little bit lobotomised when Cazorla isn't there. But then, of course, when he comes back, I suppose, that could make a difference again. But it's something you can never get away from Arsenal because they haven't even gone past March in a title challenge in the last decade. It's still difficult to imagine that changing. But there have been glimpses of something possible there. In terms of Spurs, I wouldn't be concerned with Pochettino overall. I think the project is still, you know, it's very encouraging. I think he's doing a good job. But I think this season, they've got a lot of issues. I mean, even the way he's been tinkering with the formation, Pochettino, obviously try and kind of get them out of this funk and respond to last season a bit and give them a few different options. I know players have slightly struggled with it. And it just, it's almost like they're a young team as well. So to kind of maintain that consistency from last season to this season is difficult. But then again, I mean, they actually, they weren't exactly wowing people in November last year, then came into it in January. So, you know, it's possible it could happen again.
Mm. City are the bookmakers' favourites, just. Pep Guardiola, at least, you know, he's doing perhaps what Jose Mourinho isn't doing, which is actually following a strategic plan. But he's saying they're vulnerable to that long ball. It was shown on Saturday against Burnley. They do seem, City, to be a work in progress, don't they?
Absolutely. You can still get a chance against City. I think they've failed to keep a clean sheet in nearly all their games in the Premier League so far this season. Good teams will find a way to get in behind them. Even teams that are struggling would find a way to get in behind them. You talk about Saturday's game, and you talk about that soft centre that they appear to have. And Southampton's players earlier in the season talked about targeting John Stones. Nathan Redmond said, we knew that he had a mistake in him, so we went for him and we managed to get some joy out of it. So yeah, up front sensational, as we all know, but it's at the back where they're a bit weak.
So Costa could get some joy from John Stones then?
Yeah, you'd imagine. I mean, and this is the thing, talking about momentum and when it's burst, I mean, when City started the season the way they did, that now seems actually quite a long time ago. And they did what, once they were rumbled a bit, kind of just caused, not a crisis of confidence, but just made them realise, it kind of just became so transparent that, okay, actually, this is still quite a long way from a Guardiola deal. Because, it's not just the back, I think, it's that they haven't been quite as dazzling up front, and that almost then puts more pressure onto the back line because they're just not flowing in the same way. He does have a signing or two to make.
Aguero, 34 goals, I think it is, in his last 33 games. But as far as the other players, the supporting cast are concerned, Sané not scoring enough goals. Nolito hasn't scored since October the 15th. Yes, he scored 5 goals in 20 appearances, but you need more. Kevin De Bruyne, for example, wonderful player, but you need him when Aguero isn't scoring goals. You need other players to weigh into the mix.
One of the questions coming in is, was John Stones worth the money? Now, I found it very interesting. If you talk to managers privately, they would all say they would have absolutely lumped in on him.
I suppose, first of all, in the modern market, kind of any price is relevant at this point. And, you know, football has its own hyper-reality. So in that context, it's a different issue. But I suppose with Stones, I mean, you're not paying for the player now. You're also paying for the player he's going to become in the future, what he can become under Guardiola, and what he can, because he's still so young. I think we often forget this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like 15 years ago when it would be players at absolute peak that would command this money. It's more intelligent decision making, in the sense that, you know, even beyond stuff like resale value, but the fact that you're getting 5-6 solid years ahead, that's what the money is there for.
Talking of 5-6 years ahead, could you have seen the other half of Manchester City's central defensive partnership yesterday? You're at Southampton.
Yes.
Virgil van Dijk?
He's a wonderful player. I was very, very impressed with him. He has had a lot of hype so far this season, but my word, did he live up to it in front of a national TV audience. I think he was not only strong defensively, he had Romelu Lukaku in his back pocket. He was spraying 50-yard balls all over the pitch. He was bringing the ball out of defence. He was confident. He was assured. He played with an authority. I mean, in my match report for the Daily Mirror, I used the word majestic because it was wonderful to watch him play. He's only 25 years of age. You could see him either A, inspiring Southampton maybe to get back into Europe for next season, or B, maybe a subject of some huge bids from bigger clubs, because he's a wonderful player.
I think City have some sort of meeting of the hierarchy today to discuss January signings. I think the centre half's going to be one of their primary issues.
They'll be looking for fullbacks as well.
Probably. Because I think Guardiola, he did want fullbacks in summer as well, but realised there were other kind of positions that were required prioritising. But yeah, I think it's centre half and fullback, I'd say. But instead, I mean, Van Dijk's been one name mentioned. He could go back in for Laporte as well with Bilbao. I know he signed a new contract in summer, but often with Bilbao and a club like that, so much of it depended on resale and selling on players, that just secures them for a bigger fee at a time like now.
How much do you think Van Dijk is worth?
What's the question?
And that's from Mark Hutting, by the way.
Well, what's quite interesting during the summer was that they had an interest in Kalidou Koulibaly, the centre-half at Napoli, who's had a wonderful season last year. And Farhad Moshiri, the majority shareholder, at Everton did an interview a few weeks ago where he actually admitted that they had gone to Napoli's asking price for Koulibaly, and that was £60 million. So if you're talking about quality centre-halves who know the league, who will not take any time to adapt to playing in the Premier League, who will hit the ground running, you'd have to talk about him in that sort of exorbitant figure. For me, as you say, money's starting to go out the window because we're talking crazy money now, but he's 25 years of age. He's got a big, big future ahead of him.
A lot of Liverpool fans on saying that they want Van Dijk as well. Victor Smythe, he's asking us, do we feel that Liverpool are the best footballing side in the Premier League?
I think they've probably actually got, despite what Hazard and Costa are doing, I think they've got a bit more improvisation and innovation in them, Liverpool, than either Chelsea or, say, Spurs. Chelsea and Spurs, to a degree, maybe more so with Spurs, but there is a little bit with Chelsea. They kind of overwhelm teams with energy and pressing rather than kind of more. And Chelsea do have a lot of these qualities. There is a lot of magic in them, but with Liverpool is almost a bit more, there's something a bit more dazzling about them at the moment. With Chelsea, you're kind of wowed by the power. With Liverpool, it's, you know, you're seeing kind of more some really creative things. Well, maybe a little less so since they've had a few injury problems in the last month, and we'll see what's going to happen with Coutinho.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think you look at Liverpool and they've got such a wonderful fluidity up front. Adam Lallana, an England duty, as the press was speaking to him, and he was saying there that the understanding between himself and the other players up front, almost telepathic, that's the word he used. And it is wonderful to see, because they used to be reliant on one man, Daniel Sturridge, for their goals. Mm. Now they are reliant on so many because they have so many weapons. I think they are easily the best footballing side in the Premier League at the moment.
And what about Coutinho? It looked a bad one, didn't it? Ankle ligaments, which is, you know, 2-3 months plus, maybe. Who takes his place?
Well, I mean, it's probably going to take a little bit of reshuffling from Klopp, because, I mean, the front line has seemed so solid. And even the mention of Lallana as well. I mean, I think what's so key with what Lallana does is that he was almost kind of the trigger man for all their pressing. It was once Lallana went, the rest of the team followed. I think that's why they were so cohesive. So if you take one player out, I mean we saw it when Lallana's had a few issues, but Coutinho in that as well. It's actually a little bit of a test for Klopp now, in the sense of whether he can get the same effect while reshuffling, or how much is dependent on that front four in the way he wants them.
We've had Martin Rogerson on, and he's saying, what was your view of the way that Klopp engaged the crowd? He really got them going, didn't he? There was a really emotional bond there. How important is that?
It's very important indeed, because this was always going to be their test. When the goals dried up, or if at all, or when they had injuries. Now, obviously, we talked about Coutinho being injured, Lallana, I think there was a concern about him as well. And there was a point during that game where Sunderland boss David Moyes had made it very clear that he was going to park the bus. And at that point where he G'd up the crowd and a lot of anger in his face and frustration, he was basically saying, I think somebody had misplaced a pass and there were a few groans behind him in the stand. And he turned to them and, as you say, gestured really angrily as if to say, look, get behind the team. This is the point at which they need you most.
Yeah.
And it worked because the crowd lifted themselves.
I think it's good that as well, because it's
wonderful to see. I love that. I mean, I think there's a fine line. Some crowds, I remember Mourinho saying very similar about the Chelsea crowd, that they didn't get behind their team and they were very quiet, and some fans took umbrage at that. But the Liverpool fans really did buy into it.
I suppose the existing connection with Klopp matters in that way. I mean, if it was a manager on a four games out of win trying to do it, then manage the team.
There's some links which are probably inevitable in the circumstances, linking Klopp with a potential vacancy at whatever stage at Bayern Munich. I get the impression that he's on a project here.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I know it's been broached a lot in Germany, just from what we know of Klopp's personality, and even the fact that he waited for the Liverpool job to come, and what he said about Real Madrid. I just can't see him at Bayern. He's someone like, he just doesn't suit what he is to go to such an obvious superpower where most of the advantages are financial. No, I think you're right. I can see him at Liverpool for another a decade, to be honest. All going well, of course, but... Mm.
The interesting thing about Bayern Munich is that they lost last week to Dortmund. They lost in the Champions League to Rostov. They were very fortunate in the weekend with their win on Saturday night. And I think as far as Ancelotti is concerned, there has been some concern. Red Bull Leipzig are in front in the Bundesliga and going very well indeed. as you say, it has been said that Klopp could be a fit, but I think Klopp has a project. I think the Premier League is the place to be right now in terms of those top-line managers, of which he is one. And I think that he... It was very interesting they gave him that long-term contract out of the blue, didn't they? That, and everyone wondered, why has he got that, for being funny? Mm-hmm. And I think as far as Klopp is concerned, they've obviously given that to him to give him the security so that he can actually build something sustainable for the future rather than just restoring them to the top and walking away.
Mm. And we've had Abhishek Sridhar on, Migs. He's basically asking, will this lack of European involvement be to the benefit of both Chelsea and Liverpool?
I think it's... I mean, I was going to do something about it this weekend, because I think it's obviously such an advantage now. And even the way, if you look at the stats from the 2004, 2009, 2010 era, when there was such an obvious top four, it didn't matter in the same way, because that kind of fixed big four at the time, which was United, Liverpool, Arsenal and Chelsea, we just kind of had those places sewn up. But since there's obviously been the influence of a bit more, like Spurs have come on, obviously the City money, and now it's basically six or seven trying to get into four. The advantage that gives teams, just the amount of work they can do, the training ground, especially with Conte and Klopp, who are two managers who, so much of their work is based, as you mentioned earlier, coaching players and getting the best out of them and putting systems in place. And the more time you have to do that, obviously, the more integrated the team would be, there's fewer injuries. And the stats are clear. In the last few years, I think this season could be the first then where two teams not involved in the Champions League or in any European football, which is Chelsea and Liverpool, could finish top four. But it's been growing. I think the last few seasons, there's always been one up there that hasn't been involved in Europe.
Mm. We've had Carl Murter on. Now, he is direct and to the point. Will Manchester United make the top four?
That's a really good question, because you'd have to worry about the fact that I think in the last seven games they've only scored two goals once, and that was against Swansea. Defensively, they're vulnerable from set pieces, and obviously West Ham managed to get some joy yesterday at Old Trafford. You'd have to be concerned. That said, Mourinho did make the point that when he won the league a few years ago, City were 10 points behind at one stage and managed to bridge that gap. So it is possible, but United have to click, and they have to click fairly quickly.
Now, we talk about Jose Mourinho every week. Would he benefit, and would Manchester United benefit, from him not being the story for once?
I suppose the thing about it is, though, the only way to do that is win games. I mean, this is what it all comes down to. In answer to the question, actually, I don't think United will finish top four. And I think there are bigger issues. I mean, even to come back to what we're talking about with Conte and Klopp and, putting systems in place, United's system isn't as obvious. Like, what they're actually trying to do isn't as obvious. It does seem a lot of the attacking is off the cuff. Now, that does mean that when they're on form, they can be very good. But when players aren't on form, it's like they have no fallback of a system to rely on. And I think the actual irony of it is, I've seen United play worse winning games than they have been in the last few home draws. I think they've actually been quite good. They were good against Arsenal last week with Rashford up front. I mean, on balance, they probably should have won yesterday's game. And so from that perspective, you think if they're playing like that, then there aren't too many concerns. But then the overriding worry then is, what happens if, the more you draw these games, the more doubt creeps in, then that causes issues. And then on top of all that, if you have kind of Mourinho controversies every week, it does kind of create this atmosphere around the club, and it means anytime there's a setback or they go behind, it just it causes more issues,
because they knew what they were getting into. We'd heard ad nauseam about Bobby Charlton, not really being convinced by Mourinho, not as a football man but as a person almost. They can't be surprised with the baggage that comes with Jose Mourinho, can they?
You see, I for the first time, we're going to disagree here, because I football manager is passionate about his team not getting a decision his way. I mean, as it turned out, Mark Noble takes a swipe and Paul Pogba did dive. The referee was absolutely right in the judgment that he made. But Mourinho's under pressure. He's at the biggest club in the world and his team are not clicking. His team are not winning games. As you say, you just mentioned all of the issues that are coming together to make it difficult for him. But he expressed frustration. I mean, what is wrong with that?
A bit forced to me.
Yeah, I thought it possibly did.
Maybe it was, we see all the time managers doing things to get a reaction from their players. And so you're probably absolutely right about that. But I see... Listen, I was at a meeting just before the start of the season where there were representatives from the FA, the Football League, the Premier League, all telling us that we're going to crack down on manager behaviour this season on the touchline, on the pitch. We are going to make sure that fourth officials don't get harassed. We're going to make sure this, that and the other. I've seen all sorts go on this season. You know, and no focus whatsoever. I've seen referees harassed. I've seen inconsistency where some referees book for dissent and other referees don't. I've seen fourth officials harassed on the touchline. And yet Mourinho does it, and he is the worst person in the world. And I'm not a United fan. I'm not a United defender. I'm not Mourinho defender. But I would say that I just have a bit of sympathy in this situation because somebody else does it, they don't get anywhere near the focus.
I think there's a big... I know, obviously, officials kind of treat these things on a case-by-case basis and there should be no prejudice in these things, but I think we can't escape from the fact that there is a kind of a wider tapestry here. And even when we look at the referee involved yesterday, this is a referee that John Mourinho Moss. Called weak. And there is probably a sense, even if it's subconscious... But as soon as Mourinho gets out of line, right, we have the chance to do him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the referees, ex-referees, Graham Pohl, said he thinks, he's done a column today where he says he thinks referees psychologically have it in their heads, we want to make an example of Jose Mourinho. Is that fair to the guy? I mean, there are lots of
possibly other... Possibly human nature, isn't it? But given all the circumstances, Miguel, how important is it that they beat West Ham in the League Cup quarter-final this week?
Yeah, I mean... All the more so because I think in both of his jobs in England, actually, the League Cup has been the first trophy that Mourinho has won. And for all that's going on at the club, if you get that piece of silverware, it can have that kind of transformative effect. And obviously so with Mourinho. The League Cup didn't actually make much of a difference last season. But it's a different sort of dynamic. And United are trying to build up something again. And even if they're not quite there, winning the League Cup can just cause that lift. I mean, if you look at Ferguson's last great spell as well, 05-06, for a lot of that season, United looked in a bad, bad way, won the League Cup, and it kind of caused this transformation in the side. Now, it's not necessarily the case that will follow with Mourinho now, but it would just be, you know, it would mean that no matter what else happens this season, you can just say, all right, there's the League Cup. Yeah. We haven't won it in a while.
But the fact that Travis Blizzard is asking me this question tells me that there is a bit of an undercurrent of discontent. He asks, will Manchester United sack another manager by the end of this season?
No. Absolutely not. I can't see it. I think Mourinho, his CV demands that you give him time. He's won the league in several different countries. He's won the Champions League twice. Why would you hire a man with that experience and then throw him overboard at the first sign of trouble? They stuck with Van Gaal, and the football there under Van Gaal was terrible. Yeah. I think as far as Mourinho is concerned, it would be absolute madness to get rid of him.
Mm. So following on that, Miguel, Jamie Leach asks us, which manager is under the most pressure? Now, I would obviously think Alan Pardew, who seems to have forgotten anything about defensive coaching, or certainly not getting the ideas across. Mm. There's talk that the American owners are going to see how it gets on in training, you know, the usual crisis meeting. Is he the prime candidate, or are there others out there?
Oh, actually, before I came on, I just heard earlier that apparently Palace aren't as dismayed by recent results. Well, I think they've been generally quite impressed with Pardew's work, even kind of around the club, so he's possibly not under as much tread as has been thought. It's an interesting, because this season, to be fair, maybe it speaks to the competitiveness of the league, but just every time you think that a manager is just going to suddenly go slide into this danger zone, then they get, even Bilic, I mean, just a few weeks ago, it seemed that he was going to be the first sack this season. Same Bob Bradley, I mean, had they not won against Palace on Saturday, then, you know, it would have been, because especially the nature of that game. But instead now, instead of the massive negative of having been 3-1 up and losing or drawing, he's now had the massive boost of pulling a win out of that. It's actually, the sack race actually, I wouldn't say sedate given how competitive the league is, but it doesn't seem as immediate this season. There's no one under, I mean, even Mike Field and the Hull, I think Hull are probably in big trouble. But yet, because of the circumstances, it's mitigated by all that.
Were you surprised that, you know, Palace are almost being treated as a rest home for former England managers? Roy Hodgson linked there. Sam Allardyce, who's, you know, one assumes, still in the Spanish villa, just waiting for the phone call.
Yeah, well, I would assume that is the case. Interesting with Palace, because as Miguel says, Pardew, as Bob Bradley calls him, is good friends with Steve Parish, the owner. the co-owner. I think as far as Palace are concerned, however, they are in need of somebody with Hodgson's organisational stability. I know he had a nightmare at England, but at club level he does have a decent record. They do need somebody like Allardyce who will go in and stabilise it. You mentioned rightly, and you referenced that ludicrous game at the weekend, 5-4 against Swansea, they were beaten. And we do laugh because some of the defending in that match was absolutely schoolboy. To concede two goals after being 4-3 up in second half injury time is criminal.
Well, what was the Cruyff line to say? It's not a football score, it's a hockey score.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I thought you declare after a score like that. The interesting thing with Pardew, sorry, I can't stop doing that, is that I think, however strong his friendship might be, I'm not so sure that will survive results. And that's my worry. If it continues, I'll stick with him now. But I think if it continues,
and it's a wider concern about Pardew's mind. This actual pattern right throughout his career and everything that he comes in has an effect. It does quite well, and then there's suddenly just massive slide off, and that almost seems very difficult to arrest without basically signing a striker.
Jamie Leach has come back to us. What about Ronald Koeman? You saw him yesterday. Not a happy bunny.
No, not a happy bunny at all, because Everton have won only one of their last eight games, and defensively they look poor, now conceded 15 goals so far in the Premier League. Koeman, obviously one of the finest defenders of his generation, normally a watchword for defensive stability, and turned Southampton during his time there into one of the strongest defensive outfits in the entire Premier League. But they looked slow, off the pace. That side needs surgery for my money.
I think he's one of the most overrated managers around, Koeman.
Really?
Yeah. I think he's a fundamentally good manager, but it's almost like he's often talked in this context as if he's kind of, well, like, and he's, you know, linked to United job, I suppose it covers Barcelona connection, that's part of that. But,
well, he sees himself as a forthcoming Barcelona manager.
Yeah, he has a reputation as a highly regarded manager, but not the record. Like, if you go right through his career, it's very patchy. And I think part of the thing with Everton as well was that just because of how bad it got with Martinez and how much the squad needed to change, any sort of different person came in, no matter who was, it was always going to be that lift just because it was something different. But I would be slightly concerned about the slide since.
See, I disagree with that for a very simple reason. I look at the Everton side and I see there is something intrinsically wrong with that side. It cost Martinez his job, but I don't think it means that Koeman's a bad manager. I think Koeman did terrifically well.
I don't think he's a fundamentally good manager, but it's the way he's talked of. And I think he's a flawed manager as well.
I think as far as... sorry, do you mean the flawed manager as in...
I mean, if you go right through his career, one of his longest jobs was one of his first, which says a lot. Since then, he's always been so willing to move. And I suppose one criticism that's happened was that there was no sense of building for the long term, right down to the fact that he jumped ship to what they actually felt was a sideways move. And then, of course, it was brought up yesterday with the kind of how well Sims played and the kind of the questions about that afterwards.
You see, I think with Koeman, he couldn't plan for the long term at Southampton because his best players kept getting taken away from him. He fought to keep Wanyama, Klein, he fought to keep...
He worked in a similar environment at Feyenoord, didn't he?
Absolutely.
Where he developed himself.
Yes, he did. But the point is that when you're trying to stabilise in, this is a much tougher league than any other. We can talk about quality and technical ability and whatever else, but this is a tougher league to survive in when you do lose your best players, and he did lose them. I accept that he wouldn't sign a longer term deal. They obviously wanted more stability. He wanted to see out his contract, and so he did jump ship. But I still do think he's a good manager. Defensively, they were strong. They played good football. I think Everton have problems within that squad, and I think that the reason why he wants to perform surgery and they went for lots of players isn't just because they want to move to another level, but because there are lots of big talents overhyped in that Everton squad. There are lots of players who want to move on and go on to better things. He's got to rip it up and start again, and I think he will do that, because what we saw yesterday, that Southampton side, who were without their two best players, Dusan Tadic and Sofyan Boufal, their record signing, they were streets ahead and should have won by more goals.
We've got Southampton playing Arsenal in the League Cup as well. Question from Ashley Worley. Where do you think, Miguel, Arsenal will finish?
Top four. And to be honest, almost week to week, my mind wavers between them. Yeah, this season they can actually challenge the same old Arsenal. it's so difficult. And to be fair, actually, for all the criticism of Wenger over the past decade, I suppose, he's wedded to certain principles. I think he has been very proactive this season. He has changed a few things. And I actually think Klopp has influenced a little bit in the way he's used Alexis as a striker.
Yes.
And I think Alexis almost presses for Arsenal in the way that Lallana does for Liverpool. It's not completely the same, but there are similarities. And I think one issue with Arsenal over the last few years actually has not just been with the way that they haven't won. It's been actually a lot of the time the football has been a bit ponderous. Yes. And it's been so kind of removed from Wenger's best football in 98 and 2004 and 2002. But this season, sometimes they've been electric on the break sometimes. Now, it helps when Bellerin and Casorla are in the team, which they aren't now. I suppose that it's going to come back to one of the same old issues, keeping certain players fit. But top four anyway.
Last question from Simon Murphy about Leicester. Do you think, Darren, that they will recover and in the Premier League? That they've definitely lacked that buzz about the place, haven't they?
Mm. I read a terrific piece by a chap called Graham Bryce, who writes for The Sun today, where he likened Leicester to Buster Douglas, who lasted 430 seconds of his subsequent fight after knocking out Mike Tyson. And it was the shortest reign as champion ever. I think as far as Leicester are concerned, it's quite disappointing. And I do use that word disappointing, because I think to say anything else patronises them. I think they are a good enough team and they have a good enough squad. They've bought well during the summer to be doing better than they have in the Premier League. It's almost as if they've prioritised another fairy tale in the Champions League, which would be wonderful if it comes off, but they've got a duty to do much better in the Premier League. And I think they've been okay at home. I know they drew at the weekend, but away from home, they've been all over the place. And it's really disappointing to see from a side that really did impress all of us last season. I think, hopefully, they will stabilise, but they have got to do better. And the attitude within that squad, Vardy's not scored anywhere near enough goals, considering what he did last season to earn the Footballer of the Year. And defensively, they've been poor. A lot of improvement needed, but I do hope they'll climb the table.
You know, we're all engaged by the ups and downs of football. And we've talked, you know, for the last half an hour or so about what is turning into being, you know, a really fascinating season. I think it would be remiss of us not to mention the overwhelming story that we're all living through at the moment, the sexual abuse scandal. It strikes me that this is the most important story that any of us have ever been covering.
All the more so because it goes beyond football, because even this has implications for people at all levels of football. So much of football is based on volunteerism. And even the questions that this a story like this brings, and I suppose what's particularly remarkable, even beyond the basic details we've seen so far, which are obviously staggering, but it's that every two, three, actually every day, really, the story gets bigger. There's more coming out, and you know the picture is building that of something really wide here, and really that takes in a lot more than one or two clubs.
Yeah, to Miguel's point, Darren, Mark Palios was on TV this morning, talking about dozens of coaches being banned as a result of a football commission in 2001. Now, I must confess, I never even heard of that.
No, nor had I. And Richard Caborn, the former sports minister, has been talking about the fact that it had been, quote-unquote, in his entree that year, and that he had spoken to other people about the fact that concerns had been raised. Well, if that is the case, Guy, why have we not been told about it? Why were we not told subsequently about it when child protection...
It should be the most pressing question they were dealing with.
Absolutely. It frustrates me because the overriding feeling that I have is that football doesn't know how to deal with this story. The FA announced a hotline in response to the allegations that were explosive last season involving one of the clubs within the game. By the time that hotline had been announced, other players, as you say, Miguel, had come out and told their harrowing stories. You just get the sense right now, even now, because the FA obviously responded to a piece by Oliver Holt in the Mail on Sunday yesterday, articulating that view that they appeared not to know what they were doing. And they announced that they have a review and an inquiry.
But that's classic bureaucratic
reactions. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Football right now doesn't know how to deal with this story. There has been a complacency right from the very start, highlighted by the Guardian journalist Daniel Taylor in his piece with Andy Woodward. And subsequently, there has been a cluelessness.
And the fact's been for two decades. Like, someone said this is 2 decades. So that, I mean... talking about bureaucracy, that illustrates, or it's made it so much worse as well, because so much has been allowed to calcify, basically. And it's as you say, they don't seem to know how to unpick it.
But football needs leadership on this. But who's going to give it? Who's going to hold crew to account? Who's going to say to Dario Gradi, for example, and I will name him because he's been saying so far, being told I've got to keep out of it. There are lots of people who feel that that's not enough from a club at the centre of a story that has dominated the news agenda. That's not enough. We need to hear from the chairman. We need to hear from anyone who was employed at that club during that time. We need to hear from everybody connected with any club that's implicated, because right now what we have had from football isn't enough.
I agree with Darren. If you see brave men weep and you wonder about the cowards who should and could have done more. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast. Be sure to join us on Facebook Live next Monday at 12:30.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.